Richard Heinberg's book Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, chapters 13, 14, and 15. Chapter 13, Our Evanescent Culture and the Awesome Duty of Librarians. How secure is our civilization's accumulated knowledge? It is a question that, in a fundamental sense, transcends many of the life and death scenarios, threats of sickness, natural disaster, or military invasion, that prompt us to spend fortunes on insurance, healthcare, and weaponry. We know that we each individually will die, though we are willing to go to great length to delay the event as long as possible. But we have an overarching shared interest in making sure that the world of ideas will go on without us, that our descendants will continue to compose music, invent tools, refine scientific knowledge, and write histories extending into the indefinite future, the cumulative, constantly evolving universe of signs, symbols, and skills that have enriched our lives. Cultural death, the passing of the wisdom, artistic creations, and practical knowledge of an entire people, painstakingly built over many generations, is a loss almost too wrenching to contemplate. Yet cultures do die. The examples from history are legion. Anthropologists and archaeologists have identified more than 10,000 distinct human cultures, most of which have perished, many by absorption into one multi-ethnic civilization or another. Linguists have cataloged more than 6,000 human languages. Again, most are extinct or endangered, often for a similar reason: absorption of indigenous populations into multi-ethnic urban civilizations. But civilizations are also mortal. About 24 are known to have existed over the past few thousand years, and again, most are now dust. Here is perhaps the most salient fact. When past civilizations were in the process of decline and collapse, they seem to have given insufficient thought to preserving the best of their achievements. Indeed, the reverse often happened. Libraries were burned, statues defaced, tombs looted. Archaeologists make heroic efforts to piece together the histories of these vanquished empires, but they face enormous hurdles. Even the monumental and long-lasting civilization of ancient Egypt left behind more questions about itself than answers. We're not even sure how much arithmetic and geography the average educated Egyptian knew. It might seem that our own civilization's achievements are less vulnerable. After all, the sheer weight, volume, and variety of contemporary cultural materials is unprecedented, including hundreds of millions of books and more hundreds of millions of newspapers, magazines, paintings, sculptures, photographs, motion picture films, phonographic records, CDs, DVDs, websites, and on and on. But all this volume and diversity may be deceptive. In some respects, our culture is arguably more ephemeral than most others, and a surprisingly large proportion of our cultural materials is in danger of being swept away with astonishing speed, leaving virtually no trace, like a candle flame vanishing in a puff of wind. The Egyptians carved their thoughts in enduring stone. We post ours on websites that change with lightning speed and sometimes vanish altogether. If we want future generations to have the benefit of our achievements, we should start thinking more seriously about what to preserve and how to preserve it. The ascendancy of electronic media. The survival struggle of America's remaining newspapers is symptomatic of a trend that began in the 1970s, when computers started finding their ways into businesses, schools, and homes. Today, most of us are already getting our news from the screen, not from local daily print. And the trend is growing. Just about every newspaper now has a website to accompany its print edition, and many industry forecasters say that print editions may not survive much longer. Even before the beginning of the Great Recession, newspaper advertising revenues were declining steeply, and in 2009 alone, daily average circulation for 395 newspapers fell 7.1% to 34.4 million, down from 37.1 million in 2008. In recent years, the Rocky Mountain News and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer have ceased printing news have ceased print news operations, and both the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune have filed for bankruptcy. Others, like the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, have cut back their publishing schedule to only a few days per week or reduced the number of pages in the average edition. The magazine and book trades are likewise evolving quickly under pressure from the Internet. More than 300,000 new book titles still appear in the United States each year, and the book industry sales revenue continues to grow. However, many insiders think advances in digital publishing will force an unprecedented transformation of the industry, as ever fewer books are released in print versions and more in online and ebook formats, a trend already sweeping the academic textbook market. As with newspapers, most magazines now publish their content online, and some, like The Ecologist, have already gone all electronic, jettisoning their print versions. Perhaps the most economically secure of print publications are also the most ephemeral in their content, People magazine and other fixtures of the supermarket checkout line. And the production processes for books, magazines, and newspapers, from writing to typesetting, printing, and distribution, are already thoroughly computerized. Digitization has nearly completed its takeover of the motion picture, photography, and music industries. Just try to buy a package of Kodachrome film for your 35mm camera, or an analog recording of your favorite band's latest songs. And with the explosive growth of online streaming and downloading services for music, movies, and television programming, the Internet is gradually becoming the primary delivery medium for visual and audio media. Libraries are being forced to adapt as they face enormous pressure to expand digital media at the expense of traditional media. For archivists, the emerging trend can be summarized in one word: digitization. Whether the original exists on paper, vinyl, or celluloid, its future lies in an endless strings of zeros and ones encoded on magnetic or laser-etched media, which will presumably preserve the original content while making it accessible to millions or billions of people today and in future generations. At the same time, the very function of libraries is up for grabs. A presentation at the 2008 American Library Association conference, reported in Library Journal, suggested that libraries should be, quote, more and more a place to do stuff, not just find stuff. We need to stop being a grocery store and start being a kitchen, unquote. As libraries become multipurpose cultural centers, in many occasions serving as informal daytime homeless shelters, one of their primary practical functions is the provision of free public internet access, with computer included. Yet these new demands and functions arrive at a time when funding for libraries is shrinking, as city and state budgets are downsized to fit evaporating tax revenues. Preservation of digitized knowledge can become a problem simply because of obsolescence. Think of the billions of floppy disks manufactured and encoded during the years between 1980 and 2000. Few of us still have working computers capable of retrieving the data on those disks. Physical degradation is a threat as well, for both magnetic and laser-etched media. But these are hardly the worldwide information system's point of greatest vulnerability. Ultimately, the entire project of digitized cultural preservation depends on one thing: electricity. As soon as the power goes out, access to the Internet goes down. CDs and DVDs become meaningless plastic discs, ebooks become inscrutable and useless, digital archives become as illegible as cuneiform tablets, in fact, more so. Digitization represents a huge bet on society's ability to keep the lights on forever. Without precious kilowatts, what would survive? Sculpture and architecture would persist. Previous generations of sound and visual media would be decipherable. Old phonographic records could still be made to emit music, given a hand crank, needle, and megaphone, and silent films would be relatively easy to show. Books and collections of physical newspapers and magazines would fare reasonably well for a few decades, but deteriorating acid-laden paper threatens the survival of about 85% of books and nearly 100% of newspapers and magazines. Ancient books written on parchment and acid-free paper could last many more centuries. It's ironic to think that the cave paintings in Lascaux may be far more durable than photos from the Hubble Space Telescope. If the lights were to go out now, in just a century or two, the vast majority of our recently recorded knowledge would be gone or inaccessible. How likely is blackout? If we could be fully confident that a more or less permanent blackout is unthinkable, then this discussion would be a purely academic exercise. Where might such confidence come from? Two questions could help us assess the magnitude of risk. What has to go wrong for the lights to go out, and what has to go right for them to stay on? Here's a short list of what would have to go wrong. 1. Failure to replace aging infrastructure. All knowledgeable observers agree that North America's electricity grid system is overdue for a massive upgrade. According to electrical industry consultant Jason McKenzie, in his 2007 book, Lights Out, The Electricity Crisis, The Global Economy, What It Means to You, quote, "You almost can't read a report on the U.S. electricity industry that doesn't decry the state of the nation's transmission grid," unquote. The consequences of failure to invest tens of billions in new infrastructure will be more frequent and ever longer back blackouts and brownouts, leading perhaps to electricity rationing and a host of fairly dire economic inputs. 2. Unavailability of sufficient investment capital. Replacing infrastructure will require capital and political will. The current grid was built when energy was cheap, demand for electricity was lower, and the economy was growing at a rapid pace. Today, investment capital is scarce, so the federal government will have to pay for most of the grid upgrade. But the U.S. budget is already overextended in paying for bailouts and stimulus packages, not to mention a global spanning military presence. Until an unavoidable crisis arises, grid investment is likely to continue being moved back in the line of projects needing money. 3. Inability of the industry to maintain sufficient supplies of fossil fuels for electricity generation. In my 2009 book, Blackout, I discussed credible reports suggesting that U.S. coal production could peak in the years between 2020 and 2030 and decline afterwards, with prices for the resource inevitably escalating. Natural gas seems plentiful for the time being, but continued exploration and production from new shale gas plays require high gas prices. Further, problems with well productivity, limits to potential drilling locations, and low energy return on energy invested may render the new shale gas plays a mere flash in the pan, as I argued in my 2013 book, Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. 4. Inability of alternatives to make up for fossil fuels. If higher-priced and soon-to-be-scarce coal and gas could be easily, quickly, and cheaply replaced with other energy sources, fossil fuel supply limits would pose no great difficulty. However, all of the available alternatives are inadequate in one way or another. Yes, we could have more wind, solar, geothermal, and tidal power, but it will also take time and enormous amounts of investment capital, see above, and most of these alternatives are intermittent energy sources. And with transport of workers, fuel, and waste compromised by oil depletion, and availability of cooling water rendered unpredictable by droughts and flooding associated with climate change, nuclear power will become more of a problem than a solution. 5. Nuclear war. The electromagnetic pulse generated by the explosion of hydrogen bombs has the capacity to fry the grid and the hundreds of millions of electrical devices plugged into it nearly instantaneously. For war planners, this possibility is not only real and credible, it is one of the greatest causes of worry with regard to national survival following any nuclear exchange. 6. Solar pulse, geomagnetic storm. Under rare circumstances, an extremely intense solar flare has the capability of wiping out electrical grids across entire continents. In 1989, one such storm caused a blackout across Quebec. the largest recorded geomagnetic storm, often referred to as the Carrigan event, occurred in September 1st and 2nd, 1859. Telegraph wires in both the United States and Europe lit up, in some cases shocking telegraph operators and causing fires. In an event of similar magnitude were to occur today, millions of electronic devices would be permanently damaged, along with crucial high-voltage transformers that maintain electricity grids. A similar intensity solar eruption aimed at our planet will inevitably occur at some point. Number 7. Systemic vulnerabilities. We live in a world that is increasingly interconnected and in which the pursuit of economic efficiency has reduced overall resilience. In such a system, problems in one area have a way of spilling over to create more problems elsewhere. For example, difficulties with oil supply will also inevitably impact the electricity system, since spare parts and fuel, especially coal, for that system are made and/or transported with oil. Similarly, problems with the electrical grid will impact oil supply, since pumps and refineries require alternating current. Natural disasters, sabotage, social breakdown, and economic collapse would have knock-on effects, some too circuitous to predict, that will imperil continued reliable delivery of electrical power. What has to go right in order to avert grid breakdown? In many respects, this list is a mirror image of the previous one. Successful massive investments in grid upgrades, as discussed above, these are far from being assured. A rapid, successful conversion to alternative energy sources, again, as mentioned above, this is a long shot at best. Averting of international conflicts that might go nuclear, so far so good. Averting of grid breakdowns due to natural disasters, etc., or rapid recovery from such problems. Society has been able to do this for decades, even in the worst, in the case of hurricanes, earthquakes, and wars. Recovery was usually rapid, but increasingly crises are becoming synergistic. The breakdown of electricity supply systems is not just a matter of theory. In about 100 nations around the globe, supplies of power are already problematic. Consider just one example, the nuclear-armed nation of Pakistan. Here's a quote from an article posted a few years ago on the website All Things Pakistan. Quote, "While rolling blackouts or load shedding is, as it's locally known, always has been a staple of daily life in Pakistan, the problem has become acute in the last couple of years. In the second half of December, the situation got so bad that WAPDA and KESC, power generation entities in Pakistan, resorted to draconian levels of load shedding. The power cuts during this time amounted to 20 to 22 hours a day in most small cities and even cities like Karachi, where we're seeing 18-plus hours of load shedding." Unquote. Pakistan is a poor, politically unstable country. Surely nothing like this could ever happen in a wealthy industrial nation. Yet consider the situation in Britain. In 2009, a 2009 article in The Telegraph was headlined, "Britain headed back to dark ages. The UK is facing a tipping point over the next few years in its ability to generate enough power to satisfy an ever-increasing demand." The article notes, quote, "Over the next 10 years, one-third of Britain's power-generating capacity needs to be replaced with cleaner fuels as a result of European laws on pollution. By 2025, the situation is expected to worsen." Another article, this one from the BBC, is titled, "Britain Could Face Blackouts by 2016. It quotes David McKay, a researcher at Cambridge University and soon-to-be government energy advisor, as saying, quote, "The scale of building required to avert blackouts is absolutely enormous," unquote. Generating electricity is not all that difficult in principle. People have been doing it since the 19th century, but generating it in large amounts reliably without both cheap energy inputs and secure availability of spare parts and investment capital for maintenance poses an increasing challenge. To be sure, here in the United States, the lights are unlikely to go out all at once and permanently anytime soon. The most likely scenario would see a gradual increase in rolling blackouts and other forms of power rationing, beginning a decade or two from now, with some regions better off than others. After another few years, unless governments and utilities could muster the needed effort, electricity might increasingly be seen as a luxury. Reliable, ubiquitous 24/7 power could become just a dim memory. If the challenges noted above are not addressed, many nations, including the United States, could be in such straits by the third decade of this century. In the best instance, nations would transition as much as possible to renewable power, maintaining a functional national grid of network of local distribution systems, but supplying rationed power in smaller amounts than is currently the case. Digitized data would still be retrievable part of the time by some people. Yet even distributed renewable energy systems and commercial-scale fuel cells, already being used as backups for major buildings, would be vulnerable to lack of spare parts and thus might leave communities without power for extended periods. While the internet is designed to survive if sections of the network are destroyed, the server farms that are its backbone require enormous amounts of electricity, as do the countless servers hosting private websites. Thus, even if your own forward-thinking neighborhood manages to stay powered 24/7 with solar panels and methane digesters, the servers that once stored years of your email correspondence, family photos, and financial records may be sitting dark and dead in buildings thousands of miles away. And then he has an entire paragraph that's in a parenthesis. Indeed, if you want to know the future of the internet, don't look to Google or Microsoft. Look instead to Greece, Spain, Nigeria, or Kenya, where people with little money make the most of limited online access. Maintaining the benefits of global communications in time of scarcity will depend not on our willingness to constantly update hardware and software, but on our ability to maintain the functionality of an aging set of devices using as few energy, financial, and other resources, and as little bandwidth as possible. In the worst instance, economic and social crises, wars, fuel shortages, and engineering problems would rebound upon one another, creating a snowballing pattern of systemic failures leading to permanent total blackout. It may seem inconceivable that it would ever come to that. After all, electrical power means so much to us that we assume the officials in charge will do whatever is necessary to keep the electrons flowing. But, as Jared Diamond documents in his book Collapse, elites don't always do the sensible thing, even when the alternative to rational action is universal calamity. Altogether, the assumption that long-term loss of power is unthinkable just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. A permanent blackout scenario should exist as a contingency in our collective planning process. Remember websites? Over the short term, if the power were to go out, loss of cultural knowledge would not be at the top of most people's list of concerns. They would worry more about mundane necessities like refrigeration, light, heat, and banking. It takes only a few moments of reflection or an experience of living through a natural disaster to appreciate how many of life's daily necessities and niceties would be suddenly absent. Of course, everyone did live without power until only a few generations ago, and hundreds of millions of people worldwide still manage in its absence. So it is certainly possible to carry on the essential aspects of human life sans functioning wall outlets. One could argue that post-blackout there would be a period of adaptation, during which people would reformulate society and simply get on with their business, living perhaps in a manner similar to the 19th century ancestors, their 19th century ancestors, or the contemporary Amish. The problem with that reassuring picture is that we have come to rely on electrical power for so many things, and have so completely let go of the knowledge, skills, and machinery that could enable us to live without it, that the adaptive process might not go so well. The survivors might not be able to attain a 19th century way of living without spending years, decades, or perhaps even centuries reacquiring knowledge and skills and reinventing machinery. Imagine the scene, perhaps 2 decades from now. After years of gradually lengthening brownouts and blackouts, your town's power has been down for days, and no one knows if or when it can be restored. No one is even sure if the blackout is statewide or nationwide, because radio broadcasts have become sporadic. The able members of your community band together to solve the mounting practical problems threatening your collective existence. You hold a meeting. Someone brings up the problems of water delivery and wastewater treatment. The municipal facilities require power to supply those essential services. A woman in the back of the room speaks. I once read about how you can purify water with a ceramic pot, some sand, and charcoal. It's on a website. Her voice trails off. There are no more websites. The conversation turns to food. Now that the supermarkets are closed, no functioning lights or cash registers, and emptied by looters, it's obviously a good idea to encourage backyard and community gardening. But where should townspeople get their seeds? A middle-aged gentleman pipes up. There's this great mail-order seed company. Just go online. He suddenly looks confused and sits down. Online is a word that no longer exists. Even if an order could somehow be placed, the local post office has closed its doors and its delivery trucks have run out of fuel because gas station pumps need electricity to operate. Is there something we should be doing? There's a message here for leaders at all levels of government and business, obviously so for emergency response organizations. But I've singled out librarians in this essay because they may bear the gravest responsibility of all in preparing for the possible end of electric civilization. Without widely available practical information, recovery from a final blackout would be difficult in the extreme. Therefore, it is important that the kinds of information people would need are identified and preserved in such a way that it will be accessible under extreme circumstances and to folks in widely scattered places. Of course, librarians can never bear sole responsibility for cultural preservation. It takes a village, as Hillary Clinton once proclaimed in another context. Books are clearly essential to cultural survival, but they are just inert objects in the absence of people who can read them. We also need skills-based education to keep alive both the practical and the performing arts. What good is a set of parts to the late Beethoven string quartets, arguably the greatest music our species has ever produced, if there's no one around who can play the violin, viola, or cello well enough to make sense of them? And what good would a written description of horse plowing do to a post-industrial farmer without the opportunity to learn hands-on from someone with experience? Nevertheless, for librarians, the message could not be clearer. Don't let books die. It's understandable that librarians spend much effort trying to keep up with the digital revolution in information storage and retrieval. Their main duty is to serve their community as it is, not a community that existed decades ago or one that may exist decades hence. Hence, the thought that they may be making the materials they are trying to preserve ever more vulnerable to loss should be cause for pause. There is a task that needs doing, the conservation of essential cultural knowledge in non-digital forms. This task will require the sorting and evaluation of information for its usefulness to cultural survival, triage, if you will, as well as its preservation. It may be unrealistic to expect librarians to take on this responsibility, given their existing mandate and lack of resources. But who else will do it? Librarians catalog, preserve, and make available accumulated cultural materials, especially those in written form. That's their job. What profession is better suited to accept this charge? The contemplation of electric civilization's collapse can't help but provoke philosophical musings. Perhaps cultural death is a necessary component of evolution, like the death of individual organisms. In any case, no one can prevent culture from changing, and many aspects of our present culture arguably deserve to disappear. We each probably carry our own list around in our heads of what kind of music, advertising messages, and television shows we think the world could do without. Even assuming that humans survive the current century, by no means a sure thing, another culture will arise sooner or later to replace our current electric civilization. Its co-creators will inevitably use whatever skills and notions are at hand to cobble it together, just as the inhabitants of Europe in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance drew upon cultural flotsam from the Roman Empire, as well as influences from the Arab world. And it will gradually assume a life of its own. Still, we must ask, what cultural ingredients might we want to pass along to our descendants? What cultural achievements would we want to be remembered by? What cultural ingredients might we want to pass on to our descendants? What cultural achievements would we want to be remembered by? Civilization has come at a price. Since the age of Sumer, urbanization has been terrible for the environment, leading to deforestation, loss of topsoil, and reduced biodiversity. There have been human costs as well in the forms of economic inequality, which hardly existed in pre-state societies, the loss of personal autonomy. These costs have grown to unprecedented levels with the advent of industrialism, civilization on amphetamines, and have been borne primarily not by civilization's beneficiaries, but by other species and people in poor nations and cultures. But nearly all of us who are aware of these costs like to think of this bargain with the devil as having some purpose greater than a temporary increase in creature comforts, safety, and security for a minority within society. The full-time division of labor that is the hallmark of civilization has made possible science, with its enlightening revelations about everything from human origins to the composition of the cosmos. The arts and philosophy have developed to degrees of sophistication and sublimity that escape the descriptive capacity of words. Yet so much of what we have accomplished, especially in this last few decades, currently requires for its survival the perpetuation and growth of energy production and consumption infrastructure, which exact a continued escalating environmental and human toll. At some point, this all has to stop, or at least wind down to some more sustainable scale of pillage. But if it does, and in the process we lose the best of what we have achieved, will it all have been for nothing? October 2009. Chapter 14, Our Cooperative Darwinian Moment. Evolution can be ruthless at eliminating the unfit. Red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson memorably described it. Nature routinely sacrifices billions of individual organisms and sometimes entire species in the course of its adaptive progression. We humans have been able to blunt nature's fangs. We take care of individuals who would not be able to survive on their own. The elderly, the sick, the wounded. And we've been doing so for a long time, perhaps tens of thousands of years. In recent decades, more and more of us have leapt aboard the raft of socially insured survival, though in ways that often have little to do with compassion. Today, even the most hale and hearty individuals would be hard-pressed to stay alive for more than a few days or weeks if cut adrift from supermarkets, ATMs, and the rest of the infrastructure of modern hyper-industrialism. This strategy of expanding our collective fitness has, at least temporarily, paid off. The consequent reduction in our death rate has resulted in a 700% expansion of human population in just the past two centuries, and a current population growth rate of about 80 million per year, births in excess of deaths. Humans are everywhere taking care and capacity away from most other organisms, except ones that directly serve us, such as maize and cattle. We have become expert at cooperatively avoiding nature's culling, and thus at partially, and again temporarily, defeating natural selection, at least in the way that it applies to other species. Some argue that natural selection is at work within human society whenever clever and hard-working folk get ahead while lazy dullards lag behind. The philosophy of social Darwinism holds that this kind of competitive selection improves the species. But critics point out that individual success within society can be maladaptive for society as a whole, because if wealth becomes too unequally distributed, social stability is threatened. Such concerns have led most nations to artificially limit competitive selection at the societal level. In the United States, these limits take the form of progressive income tax, Social Security, food stamps, disability payments, Medicaid, and aid for dependent children, among others. Even most self-described conservatives, quote-unquote, who think that government shouldn't prevent society's winners from taking all, still think it's good for churches to give to the needy. While the last few decades of rapid economic growth and material abundance, enabled by cheap fossil energy, led to a dramatic expansion of social safety nets in industrialized countries, they also featured the emergence of an ostensibly benign global imperial system led by the United States, whose fearsome military machine kept a lid on international conflict and whose universally accepted currency helped maintain relative international economic stability in ways that served U.S. interests, of course. Globally, deaths from wars have declined, as has mortality linked to dire poverty. So far, so good, more or less. Unfortunately, however, many key components of our successful collective efforts to beat the Reaper are essentially unsustainable. We have reduced mortality not just with antibiotics, to which microbes eventually develop immunity, but also with an economic strategy of drawing down renewable resources at rates exceeding those of natural replenishment, and of liquidating non-renewable resources as quickly as possible. By borrowing simultaneously from the past, when fossil fuels were formed, and the future, when our grandchildren will have to clean up our mess, pay our debt, and do without the resources we squander, we are effectively engaged in population overshoot. Every population ecologist knows that when a species temporarily overshoots its environment's long-term carrying capacity, a die-off will follow. And so, as the world economy stops growing and starts contracting in the coming years, the results will likely include a global increase in human mortality. Resilience theorists would say that we're entering the release phase of the adaptive cycle that characterizes all systemic development, a phase they describe as, quote, a rapid, chaotic period during which capitals, natural, human, social, built, and financial, tend to be lost and novelty can succeed, unquote. This is a notion to which we'll return repeatedly throughout this essay, and it's a useful way of conceptualizing an experience that, for those undergoing it, will probably feel a lot less like release and more like pure hell. Among the possible outcomes, government-funded safety nets become unaffordable and are abandoned. Public infrastructure decays. Economic systems, transport systems, political systems, healthcare systems, and food systems become inoperable to varying degrees and in a variety of ways. Global military hegemony becomes more difficult to maintain for a range of reasons, including political dysfunction and economic decline at the imperial core, scarcity of transport fuel, and the proliferation of cheap but highly destabilizing new weapons. And international conflict becomes more likely. Any of these outcomes increases our individual vulnerability. Everyone on the raft is imperiled, especially those who are poor, old, sick, or disabled. We could redesign our economic, political, transport, human care, and food systems to be less brittle, but suggestions along those lines have been on the table for years and have been largely rejected because they don't serve the interests of powerful groups that benefit from the status quo. Meanwhile, the American populace seems incapable of raising an alarm or responding to one, consisting, as it does, of large underclass that is overfed but undernourished, overentertained but misinformed, over-indebted and underskilled, and a much smaller overclass that lives primarily by financial predation and is happy to tune out any evidence of the dire impact of its activities. A thoroughly unsentimental reader of the portents might regard an increase in human death rate as an inevitable and potentially beneficial culling of the species. The unfit will be pruned away, the fit will survive, and humanity will be the better for it. Eventually, in theory. Or maybe the rich and ruthless will survive, and everyone else will either perish or submit to slavery. The gravest danger is that if social support systems utterly fail, overshoot could turn to undershoot. That is, population levels could overcorrect to the point that there are fewer survivors than there could have been if adaptation had been undertaken proactively, perhaps far fewer than the population just prior to the Industrial Revolution. And for those who do manage to struggle on, levels of culture and technology might plummet to a depth far below what could have been preserved had action been taken. We have a population bottleneck, as William R. Catton calls it, ahead of us no matter what we do at this point. Even if a spectacular new energy source were to appear tomorrow, it would do little more than buy us a little time before we bumped up against another natural limit. However, we still get to choose how we pass through that bottleneck. We can exert some influence on factors that will determine how many of us get through and in what condition. Cooperative or competitive adaptation. A worst-case scenario is likely to be averted only by an effective, cooperative effort to adapt to scarcity and to recover from crises. Fortunately, there are perfectly good reasons for assuming that collaborative action along these lines will in fact emerge. We are a supremely cooperative species, and even our earliest ancestors were dedicated communitarians. Other species, though they often squabble over food and potential mates, likewise engage in sharing and cooperative behavior. Members of one species sometimes even cooperate with or offer to help members of different species. Indeed, as evolutionary theorist Peter Kropotkin pointed out in his landmark 1902 book, Mutual Aid, evolution is driven by cooperation as much as by competition. More to the point, hard times can bring out the worst in people, but also the best. Rebecca Solnit argues in A Paradise Built in Hell that people tend to cooperate, share, and help out at least as much during periods of crises as during times of plenty. A critic might suggest that Solnit stretches this argument too far and that collapsing societies often feature soaring rates of crime and violence. See, for example, Argentina circa 2000. Nevertheless, she supports her thesis with compelling examples. Assuming we fail to prevent crisis and merely respond to it, we might nevertheless anticipate a range of possible futures depending upon whether we set ourselves up to compete or cooperate. At one end of the competitive cooperative scenarios spectrum, the rich few become feudal lords while everybody else languishes in direst poverty. At the other end of that spectrum, communities of free individuals cohere to produce necessities and maximize their chances for collective prosperity. Back at the competitive end of the scale, there is hoarding of food and widespread famine, while at the cooperative extreme, community permaculture gardens spring up everywhere. With more competition, people perish for lack of basic survival skills. With more collaboration, people share skills and care for those with disabilities of one kind or another. Competitive efforts by investors to maintain their advantages could lead to a general collapse of trust in financial institutions, culminating in the cessation of trade at almost every level. But with enough cooperation, people could create a non-growth-based monetary system that acts as a public utility, leading to a new communitarian economics. It's a setup. In the real world, humans are both competitive and cooperative. Always have been, always will be. But circumstances, conditioning, and brain chemistry can tend to make us more competitive or more collaborative. As we pass through the population resource economy bottleneck in the decades ahead, competitive and cooperative behaviors will in turn come to the fore in a variety of times and places. My initial point in all of this is that even in the absence of effective action to avert economic and environmental crises, we still have the capacity to set ourselves up to be either more competitive or more cooperative in times of scarcity and crisis. With the right social structures and the right conditioning, whole societies can become either more cutthroat or more amenable. By building community organizations now, we are improving our survival prospects later. But I'd go further. Here's a preliminary hypothesis for which I'm starting to collect both confirming and disconfirming evidence. We're likely to see the worst of ruthless competition in the early stage of the release phase, when power holders try to keep together what wants to fall apart and reorganize. The efforts to hang on to what we have in the face of uncertainty and fear may bring out the competitive nature in many of us. But once we're in the midst of actual crisis, we may be more likely to band together. Among elites who have enormous amounts of wealth, power, and privilege at stake, the former tendency has carried the day, and some elites largely shape the rules, regulations, and information flows within society. This means we're all caught up in a hyper-competitive and fearful moment as we wait for the penny to drop. Elites can deliberately nurture an us-versus-them mentality via jingoistic patriotism, wedge issues, and racial resentments to keep ordinary people from cooperating more to further their common interests. Revolution, after all, is in many respects a cooperative undertaking, and in order to forestall it, rulers sometimes harness the cooperative spirit of the masses in going to war against a common foreign enemy. The overcompetitiveness of this pre-release phase is playing out most prominently and fatefully in debates over austerity, quote-unquote, as nations bail out investment banks while leaving most citizens to languish under layoffs, pension cuts, and wage cuts. It seems that no measure aimed to prevent defaults and losses to investors is too draconian. But in many historic instances, Russia, Iceland, Argentina, it was only after a massive financial default, that is, once release had run its course, that nations could fundamentally revamp their monetary and banking systems, making recovery possible. That makes release, quote-unquote, sound a bit like a long-overdue vacation. It's important to emphasize, however, that what we face now is not just a collapse and reorganization of a national financial sector, but a crucial turning from the overall expansionary trajectory of civilization itself. Our collective passage through and reorganization after the release phase of this pivotal adaptive cycle can be thought of as an evolutionary event. And as noted above, evolution is driven by cooperation as much as by competition. Indeed, cooperation is the source of most of our species' extraordinary accomplishments so far. Language, which gives us the ability to coordinate our behavior across space and time, has made us by far the most successful large animal species on the planet. Our societal evolution from hunting and gathering bands to agrarian civilizations to industrial globalism required ever higher levels of cooperative behavior. As one small example, think of for a moment about the stunningly rich collaborative action required to build and inhabit a skyscraper. As we adapt and further evolve in the decades and centuries ahead, we will do so by finding ever more effective ways to cooperate. Ironically, however, during the past few millennia, and especially during the most recent century, social complexity has permitted greater concentrations of wealth, thus more economic inequality, and hence, at least potentially, more competition for control over heaps of agglomerated wealth. As Ivan Illich pointed out in his 1974 classic, Energy and Equity, there has been a general correlation between the amount of energy flowing through a society and the degree of inequality within that society. And so, as we have tapped fossil fuels to permit by far the highest energy flow rates ever sustained by any human civilization, a few individuals have accumulated the biggest pots of wealth the world has ever seen. Perhaps it should come as no surprise that it is precisely during this recent, aberrant, high-energy historic interval that social Darwinism and neoliberal economics have arisen, with the latter coming to dominate economic and social policy worldwide. The leap. With release will come the opportunity for a collaborative evolutionary surge. Recall that in the release phase of the adaptive cycle, there is expanded opportunity for novelty to succeed. Most people these days tend to think of novelty in purely technological terms, and it's true that email and Twitter can speed social change, for example, by helping organize an instant political rally. But spending hours each day alone in front of a screen does not necessarily lead to collaborative behavior, and it's just possible that we may not be able to count on our handheld devices continuing to function in the context of global economic crisis, trade disruptions, and resource shortages. Therefore, perhaps it will be in our interactions within flesh-and-blood communities that most of our decisive further innovations will arise. The details are impossible to predict, but the general outline of our needed cooperative evolutionary leap is clear. We must develop a heightened collective ability to conserve natural resources while minimizing our human impacts on environmental systems. In some respects, this might turn out to be little more than an updating of traditional society's methods of managing common grazing or hunting lands. But today the stakes are far higher. The renewed commons must extend to include all renewable and non-renewable resources, and management, quote-unquote, must bring extraction and harvest levels within the long-term ability of natural systems to recover and regenerate. At the same time, with energy flows declining due to the depletion of fossil fuels, current levels of economic inequality will become unsupportable. Adaptation will require us to find ways of leveling the playing field peaceably. Laying the groundwork for reorganization following the release phase will require building resilience into all our social structures and infrastructures. In the decades ahead, we must develop low-resource, low-energy ways of meeting human needs while nurturing an internalized imperative to keep population levels within ecosystems' long-term carrying capacity. There are those who say that we humans are too selfish and individualistic to make this kind of an evolutionary leap, and that even if it were possible, there's simply too little time. If they're right, then this may be the end of the line. We might soon wind up in the unfit bin of evolutionary history. But given our spectacular history of cooperative achievement and our ability to transform our collective behavior rapidly via language, aided for the time being with instantaneous communications technologies, it stands to reason that our species has at least a fair chance of making the cut. To be sure, evolution will be driven by crisis. We will adapt by necessity. In this release phase, there will be enormous potential for violence. Remember, release is the phase of the cycle in which capital is destroyed, and currently there are towering piles of human, built, and financial capital waiting to topple. We have been set up to compete for shards and scraps. It is no wonder that so many who sense the precariousness of our current situation have opted to become preppers and survivalists. But things will go a lot better for us if, rather than stocking up on guns and canned goods, we spend our time getting to know our neighbors, learning how to facilitate effective meetings, or helping design resilient local food systems. Survival will depend on finding cooperative paths in which sacrifice is shared, the best of our collective achievements are preserved, and compassion is nurtured. Darwin tells us that we must evolve or die, and current circumstances bring that choice into stark relief. A lot of people evidently think that fitness and selfishness are the same, but we've gotten ourselves into our current fix not because we're too good at cooperating to achieve collective fitness, but rather because in our success, we fail to take account of the finite and fragile nature of the natural systems that support us. It's true that individual initiative is important, and that groupthink can be stultifying. Yet it is our ability to innovate socially and cooperate to increase our collective fitness that has gotten us this far, and that will determine whether we survive and under what conditions, as we adapt to scarcity and reintegrate ourselves within ecosystems in the decades ahead. August 2012. Chapter 15, the final chapter. Want to change the world? Read this first. History is often made by strong personalities wielding bold new political, economic, or religious doctrines. Yet any serious effort to understand how and why societies change requires examination not just of leaders and ideas, but also of environmental circumstances. The ecological context, climate, weather, and the presence or absence of water, good soil, and other resources, may either present or foreclose opportunities for those wanting to shake up the social world. This suggests that if you want to change society, or are interested in aiding or evaluating the efforts of others to do so, some understanding of exactly how environmental circumstances affect such efforts could be extremely helpful. Perhaps the most important key in grasping the relationship between the environment and processes of societal change was articulated by American anthropologist Marvin Harris, 1927 to 2001. From the very beginning of efforts to systematically study human societies in the 18th and 19th centuries, it had become clear that there were strong correlations between how societies obtained their food, whether by hunting and gathering, horticulture, agriculture, animal herding, or fishing, and their social structures and beliefs about the world. Hunter-gatherers typically live in small peripatetic bands, having an egalitarian social structure, and regard the natural world as full of supernatural powers and personalities that can be contacted and influenced by shamans. I would say unconscious personifications. Farmers, on the other hand, stay in one place and produce seasonal surpluses that often end up subsidizing the formation of towns, as well as classes of full-time specialists in various activities, metalworking, statecraft, soldiery, banking, record-keeping, and so on. Agricultural societies also tend to develop formalized religions presided over by full-time hierarchical priestly class. These systemic distinctions and similarities have held true on different continents and throughout centuries. Harris showed how shifts from one kind of food system to another were driven by environmental opportunity and necessity, and he refined his insights into an anthropological research strategy. Marvin Harris's magnum opus was the rather difficult book Cultural Materialism, The Struggle for a Science of Culture, 1979. While he was perfectly capable of writing for the general public, others of his titles, such as Cows, Pigs, Wars, and Witches, 1974, and Cannibals and Kings, 1977, were bestsellers. In Cultural Materialism, Harris was writing for fellow anthropologists. He uses a lot of technical jargon and argues each point meticulously, presenting a surfeit of evidence. However, the kernel of Harris's theoretical contribution can be summarized rather briefly. All human societies consist of three interrelated spheres. First, the infrastructure, which comprises a society's relation to its environment, including its modes of production and reproduction. Think of this primarily as its ways of getting food, energy, and materials. Second, the structure, which comprises a society's economic, political, and social relations. And third, the superstructure, a society's symbolic and ideational aspects, including its religions, arts, rituals, sports, and games, and science. Inevitably, these three spheres overlap, but they are also distinct, and it is literally impossible to find a human society that does not feature all three in some permutation. For social change advocates, it's what comes next that should agitate the neurons. Harris's cultural materialism, quote-unquote, argues for the principle of what he calls probabilistic infrastructure determinism. That is to say, the structure and superstructure of societies are always contested to one degree or another. Battles over distribution of wealth and ideas are perennial and can have important consequences. Life in the former East Germany was very different from life in West Germany, even though both were industrial nations operating under what started out to be nearly identical ecological conditions. However, truly radical social change tends to be associated with shifts of infrastructure. When the basic relationship between a society and its ecosystem alters, people must reconfigure their political systems, economies, and ideology accordingly, even if they were perfectly happy with the previous state of affairs. Societies change their infrastructure out of necessity, for example, due to the depletion of resources, or opportunity, usually the increased availability of resources, made available perhaps by migration to new territory or by the adoption of a new technology. The agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago involved a massive infrastructural shift, and the fossil-fueled industrial revolution 200 years ago had an even greater and far more rapid impact. In both cases, population levels grew, political and economic relations evolved, and ideas about the world mutated profoundly. Explaining the former example in a bit more detail may help illustrate the concept. Harris was an early adopter of the now common view of the agricultural revolution as an adaptive response to environmental shifts at the end of the Pleistocene epoch, a period of dramatic climate change. Glaciers were receding and species, especially big herbivorous prey animals such as mammoths and mastodons, faced extinction, with human predation hurrying that extinction process along. In all centers of early agricultural activity, writes Harris, the end of the Pleistocene saw a notable broadening of the subsistence base to include more small mammals, reptiles, birds, mollusks, and insects. Such broad-spectrum systems were a symptom of hard times. As the labor costs of hunter-gatherer subsistence systems rose, and as the benefits fell, alternative sedentary modes of production became more attractive, unquote. Lifestyles based on cultivation took root and spread, and with them eventually came villages and chiefdoms. In certain places, the latter in turn mutated to produce the most radical social invention of all, the state. And here's a long quote. The paleotechnic infrastructures most amenable to intensification, redistribution, and the expansion of managerial functions were those based on the grain and ruminant complexes of the Near and Middle East, Southern Europe, Northern China, and Northern India. Unfortunately, these were precisely the first systems to cross the threshold into statehood, and they therefore have never been directly observed by historians or ethnologists. That is, no historians or ethnologists were around to witness these one-time-only events. Nonetheless, from the archaeological evidence of storehouses, monumental architecture, temples, high mounds and tells, and defensive moats, walls, towers, and the growth of irrigation systems, it is clear that managerial activities similar to those observed among surviving pre-state chiefdoms underwent rapid expansion in these critical regions immediately prior to the appearance of the state. Furthermore, there is abundant evidence from Roman encounters with quote-unquote barbarians in northern Europe, from Hebraic and Indian scriptures, and from Norse, Germanic, and Celtic sagas, that intensifier redistributor warriors and their priestly retainers constituted the nuclei of the first ruling classes in the Old World. Unquote. While I have omitted most of Harris's detailed explanation, nevertheless, we have here, in essence, an ecological explanation for the origin of civilization. What's more, Harris is not merely proposing an entertaining just-so story, but a scientific hypothesis that can be tested within the limits of available evidence. Cultural materialism is capable of illuminating not just grand societal shifts, such as the origin of agriculture or the state, but the deeper functions of cultural institutions and practices of many sorts. Harris's excellent textbook, Cultural Anthropology, 2000 and 2007, co-authored with Orna Johnson, includes chapters with titles such as Reproduction, Economic Organization, Domestic Life, and Class and Caste. Each features illustrative sidebars showing how a relevant cultural practice, peacekeeping among the Menicho of central Brazil, polyandry among the Nyabi of Nepal, is adaptive to environmental necessity. Throughout this and all of his books, indeed throughout his entire career, Harris aimed to show that probabilistic infrastructure determinism is the only sound basis for a true science of culture, capable of producing testable hypotheses to explain why societies evolve the way they do. Why is this important now? for the simple reason that our own society is on the cusp of an enormous infrastructural transformation, which is remarkable because we're still reeling from the previous one, which began just a couple of centuries ago. The fossil-fueled Industrial Revolution entailed a shift from reliance on mostly renewable energy sources, firewood, field crops, and some water power, wind for sails, and animal muscle for traction, to cheaper, more controllable, more energy-dense, and, in the case of oil, more portable, non-renewable sources. Oil has given us the ability to dramatically increase the rate at which we extract and transform Earth's bounty via mining machinery, tractors, and powered fishing boats, as well as the ability to transport people and materials at high speed and low cost. It and the other fossil fuels have also served as feedstocks for greatly expanded chemical and pharmaceutical industries, and have enabled a dramatic intensification of agricultural production while reducing the need for field labor. The results of fossil fueling our infrastructure have included rapid population growth, the ballooning of the middle class, unprecedented levels of urbanization, and the construction of a consumer economy. While elements of the scientific revolution were in place a couple of centuries prior to our adoption of fossil fuels, cheap fossil energy supplied a means of vastly expanding scientific research and applying it to the development of a broad range of technologies that are themselves directly or indirectly fossil-fueled. With heightened mobility, immigration greatly increased, and the democratic multi-ethnic nation-state became the era's emblematic political institution. As economies expanded almost continually due to the abundant availability of high-quality energy, neoliberal economic theory emerged as the world's primary ideology of societal management. It soon evolved to incorporate several unchallenged, though logically unsupportable notions, including the belief that economies can grow forever and the assumption that the entire natural world is merely a subset of the human economy. Now, however, our still new infrastructural regime based on fossil fuels is already showing signs of winding down. There are two main reasons. One is climate change. Carbon dioxide produced in the burning of fossil fuels is creating a greenhouse effect that is warming the planet. The consequences will be somewhere between severe and cataclysmic. If we continue burning fossil fuels, we're more likely to see a cataclysmic result, which could make continuation of industrial agriculture and perhaps civilization itself problematic. We do have the option to dramatically curtail fossil fuel consumption to avert catastrophic climate change. Either way, our current infrastructure will be a casualty. The second big reason our fossil fuel-based infrastructure is endangered has to do with depletion. We're not running out of coal, oil, or natural gas in the absolute sense, but we have extracted these non-renewable resources using the best first or low-hanging fruit principle. With oil, the most strategically important of the fossil fuels, because of its centrality to transportation systems, we have already reached the point of diminishing returns. Compared to a decade ago, the global petroleum industry has more than doubled its rate of investment in exploration and production, while actual rates of global crude oil production, that is, extraction, have flatlined. Costs of extraction are rising, and drillers are targeting geological formations that were formerly considered too problematic to bother with. With oil, the fate of the world's economy appears to hang on the outcome of a race between technology and depletion. While industry spokespeople and media pundits tend to cheer new technologies such as hydraulic fracturing or fracking, persistently high oil prices and soaring production costs suggest that depletion is in fact pulling ahead. Coal and natural gas production will likely encounter similar diminishing returns limits within the next decade, both in the United States and worldwide. At a bare minimum, climate change and fossil fuel depletion will force society to change to different energy sources, giving up reliance on energy-dense and controllable coal, oil, and gas, in favor of more diffuse and intermittent renewable sources like wind and solar. This in itself is likely to have enormous societal implications. While electric passenger cars running on power supplied by wind turbines and solar panels are feasible, electric airliners, container ships, and 18-wheel trucks are not. Distributed energy generation from renewables, together with a decline in global shipping and air transport, may favor less globalized and more localized patterns of economic and political organization. However, we must also consider the strong likelihood that our looming, inevitable shift away from fossil fuels will entail a substantial reduction in the amount of useful energy available to society. Wind and sunlight are abundant and free, but the technology used to capture energy from these ambient sources is made from non-renewable minerals and metals. The mining, manufacturing, and transport activities necessary for the production and installation of wind turbines and solar panels currently requires oil. It may theoretically be possible to replace oil with electricity from renewables in at least some of these processes, but for the foreseeable future, wind and solar technologies can best be thought of as fossil fuel extenders. Nuclear power, with its unbreakable reliance on mining and transport, is likewise a fossil fuel extender, but a far more dangerous one, given unsolved problems with accidents, nuclear proliferation, and waste storage. When the construction and decommissioning of power plants and the mining and processing of uranium are all taken into account, nuclear power also offers a relatively low energy return on the energy invested, EROEI, in producing it. Relatively low energy returns on investment from both nuclear and renewable energy sources may themselves result in societal change. The EROEI of fossil fuels was extremely high in comparison with that of energy sources previously available. This was a major factor in reducing the need for agricultural field labor, which in turn drove urbanization and the growth of the middle class. Some renewable sources of energy offer a better EROEI than firewood or agricultural crops, but none can compare with coal, oil, and gas in their heyday. This suggests that the social consequences of the end of cheap fossil energy may include a partial re-ruralization of society and a shrinking of the middle class. The latter process is already beginning in the United States. With less useful energy available, the global economy will fail to grow and will likely enter a sustained period of contraction. Increased energy efficiency may cushion the impact but cannot avert it. With economies no longer growing, our current globally dominant neoliberal political economic ideology may increasingly be called into question and eventually overthrown. While energy is key to society's infrastructure, other factors require consideration as well. Fossil fuels are depleting, but so are a host of additional important resources, including metals, minerals, topsoil, and water. So far, we have made up for depletion in these cases by investing more energy in mining lower-grade ores, by replacing soil nutrients with commercial fertilizers, made from fossil fuels, many of them, and by transporting water, food, and other goods from places of local abundance to regions in which these materials are scarce. This strategy has increased the human carrying capacity of our planet, but may not work much longer as energy itself becomes scarcer. Further alterations in the links between environment and society will arise from climate change. Even assuming that nations undertake dramatic reductions in carbon emissions soon, cumulative past emissions virtually guarantee continued and increasing impacts that will include rising sea levels and worsening droughts and floods. By mid-century, hundreds of millions of climate refugees may be in search of secure habitat. There are optimistic ways of viewing the future, based on assumptions that fossil fuels are in fact abundant and will last another century or more, that new nuclear power technologies will be more viable than current ones, that renewable energy sources can be scaled up quickly, and that likely impacts of climate change have been overestimated. Even if one or more of these assumptions turns out to be correct, however, the evidence of declining returns on energy and financial investments in oil extraction cannot be disregarded. An infrastructural shift is underway. Considering oil's role in industrial agriculture, this shift will undoubtedly and profoundly impact our food system. And food, which is our most basic energy source from a biological perspective, is at the core of every society's infrastructure. Whether or not optimistic assumptions are valid, we probably face an infrastructure revolution at least as significant as the Industrial Revolution. But the error bars on energy supplies and climate sensitivity include more pessimistic possibilities. A faltering of useful fossil energy supply rates could trigger an unwinding of the global financial system as well as international conflict. It is also possible that the relationship between carbon emissions and atmospheric temperatures is nonlinear, with Earth's climate system subject to self-reinforcing feedbacks that could result in a massive die-off of species, including our own. Choose your assumptions: optimistic, pessimistic, or somewhere in between. In any case, this is a big deal. We are living at a historic moment when the structure of society, economic and political systems, and its superstructures, ideologies, are about to be challenged as never before. When infrastructure changes, what seemingly was solid melts into air, paradigms fall, and institutions crumble until a new societal regime emerges. Think of a caterpillar pupating, its organ systems evidently being reduced to undifferentiated protoplasm before reorganizing themselves into the features of a butterfly. What a perfect opportunity for an idealist intent on changing the world. Indeed, fault lines are already appearing throughout society. From a cultural materialist point of view, the most important of these relate to how the inevitable infrastructure change will occur. Proponents of distributed renewable energy sources are the underdogs, while the defenders of centralized fossil energy systems the incumbents, in the deepening disputes over subsidies and other elements of government energy policy. Meanwhile, grassroots opposition to extreme fossil fuel extraction methods is springing up everywhere that companies are fracking for oil and gas, drilling in deep water, mining tar sands, or blasting mountaintops to mine coal. Opposition to an oil pipeline is fueling one of the hottest political fires in Washington, D.C. And concern about climate change has acquired an intergenerational dimension, as young people across America sue state governments and federal agencies for failing to develop climate action plans. Young people, after all, are the ones who will be forcibly face the consequences of climate change, and their attitude toward older generations may not be forgiving. We are also seeing increasing conflict over the structure of society, its systems of economic distribution and political decision-making. As economic growth grinds to a halt, the world's wealthy investor class is seeking to guarantee its solvency and maintain its profits by shifting costs onto the general public via bailouts, austerity measures, and quantitative easing, which lowers interest rates, flushing money out of savings accounts and into the stock market. Jobs downsize and wages fall, but the number of billionaires billows. However, rising economic inequality has its own political costs, as documented in Amazon's recent best-selling book, a 700-page tome called Capital in the 21st Century, which unfortunately fails to grasp the infrastructural shift that is upon us or its implications for economy and society. Polls show rising dissatisfaction with political leaders and parties throughout the West. But in most countries, there is no organized opposition group poised to take advantage of this widespread discontent. Instead, political and economic institutions are themselves losing legitimacy. Infrastructural tremors are also reverberating throughout international geopolitics. The world's dominant superpower, which attained its status during the 20th century, at least partly because it was the home of the global oil industry, is now quickly losing diplomatic clout and military credibility, quote-unquote, as the result of a series of disastrous miscalculations and blunders, including its invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. Coal-fueled China is just now becoming the world's largest economy, though it and other second-tier nations, the UK, Germany, Russia, are themselves beset with intractable and growing economic contradictions, pollution dilemmas, and resource limits. Society's superstructure is also subject to deepening rupture, with neoliberalism coming under increasing criticism, especially since 2008. However, there is a more subtle and pervasive, and therefore potentially even more potent, superstructure to modern society, one largely taken for granted and seldom named or discussed, and it is likewise under assault. Essayist John Michael Greer calls this the civil religion of progress. As Greer has written, the idea of progress has quietly become the central article of faith in the modern industrial world, more universally held than the doctrine of any organized religion. The notion that history has a direction and it has to make cumulative progress in that direction has been common to both capitalist and communist societies throughout the past century. But what will happen to that religious, quote-unquote, conviction as the economy shrinks, technology fails, population declines, and inventors fail to come up with ways of managing society's multiplying crises? More to the point, how will billions of fragile human psyches adjust to seeing their most cherished creed battered repeatedly against the shoals of reality? And what new faith will replace it? Michael, I'm looking at you, dude. Greer suggests that it will be one that reconnects humanity with nature, though its exact form is yet to reveal itself. We're looking at you, Dad! All these trends are in their very earliest phases. As infrastructure actually shifts, as fuels deplete, as weather extremes worsen, tiny cracks in the edifice of business as usual will become unbridgeable chasms. Here's my last big takeaway message for would-be social changers. Only ideas, demonstration projects, and policy proposals that fit our emerging infrastructure will have genuine usefulness or staying power. Only ideas, demonstration projects, and policy proposals that fit our emerging infrastructure will have genuine usefulness or staying power. How can you know if your idea fits the emerging infrastructure? There's no hard and fast rule, but your idea stands a good chance if it assumes we are moving toward a societal regime with less energy and less transport, and that it is therefore more localized. If it can work in a world where climate is changing and weather conditions are extreme and unpredictable, if it provides a way to sequester carbon rather than releasing more of it into the atmosphere, and if it helps people meet their basic needs during hard times. It's fairly easy to identify elements of our society's existing structure and superstructure that won't work with the infrastructure toward which we appear to be headed. Consumerism and corporatism are two big ones. These were 20th century adaptations to cheap, abundant energy. They justifiably have been the objects of a great deal of activist opposition in recent decades. There were reforms or alternatives to consumerism and corporatism that could have worked within our industrial infrastructure regime, or that did work in some places, not others. European-style industrial socialism is the primary example, though that might be thought of as a magnetic hub for a host of idealistic proposals championed by thousands, maybe even millions, of would-be world changers. But industrial socialism is arguably just as thoroughly dependent on fossil-fueled infrastructure as corporatism and consumerism. To the extent that it is, activists who are married to an industrial socialist vision of an ideal world may be wasting many of their efforts needlessly. Historic examples offer useful ways of grounding social proposals. In the current context, it is important to remember that almost all of human history took place in a pre-industrial, pre-progress, quote-unquote, context. So it should be fairly easy to differentiate desirable from undesirable societal adaptations to analogous challenges in past eras. For example, anarchist philosopher and evolutionary biologist Peter Kropotkin, in his book Mutual Aid, praised medieval European cities as sites of autonomy and creativity, though the period during which they flourished is often thought of as a dark age. There are plenty of activist projects underway now that appear thoroughly aligned with the post-fossil-fueled infrastructure toward which we are headed, including permaculture cooperatives, eco-villages, local food campaigns, and transition initiatives. Relevant new economic trends include the collaborative economy, the sharing economy, collaborative consumption, distributed production, P2P finance, and the open source and open knowledge movements. While some of the latter merely constitute new business models that appear to spring from web-based technologies and social media, their attractiveness may partly derive from a broad shared cultural sense that the centralized systems of production and consumption, characteristic of the 20th century, are simply no longer viable and must give way to more horizontal distributed networks. The list of existing ideas and projects that could help society adapt to a post-fossil fuel era is long. Plenty of people have sensed the direction of global change and come to their own sensible conclusions about what to do without any awareness of Harris's cultural materialism. But such awareness could help at the margins by reducing wasted effort. Do you want to change the world? More power to you. Start by identifying your core values: fairness, peace, sustainability, stability, beauty, resilience, whatever. That's up to you. Figure out what ideas, projects, proposals, or policies further those values, but fit also with the infrastructure that's almost certainly headed our way. Then get to work. There's plenty to do and lots at stake. June 2014. The end of the book.